Everybody, my name's Bill. I am an alcoholic. Welcome to the Let's Wind Bill Up and See What Happens workshop. Tonight, I'm doing 6 weeks, and tonight is the third week, and tonight's topic title is Forgiveness Enough? And I'm going to talk a lot about step three and the resentment inventory, and then give the concluding whatever at the end. I don't know about you guys, but I mean, this weekend's been a complete nightmare. I mean, oh my God! It's funny because it was so hot that the dashboard navigator I have completely just burnt up. It just like melted, basically. So kind of weird, but moving on. It's good to be back at this group. I have a lot of respect for this group, so it's always cool to be presenting here and to be sharing myself, so thank you for that. I want to start with a random statement of truth, and then I'm going to get into the material that I'd like to cover. Now, when I say what I'm about to say first, what I'd like you to do is to observe your mind's response to what I'm going to say. Because although our lives have proven what I'm going to say thousands of times, pay attention to how the mind responds to the statement, okay? So I'm going to say something, and then what I want you to do is kind of go within and notice like how your mind sort of tilts and kind of doesn't know how to respond to it, because it's a statement of busting your mind, basically. So it's always interesting to see what the mind's response is to it. The statement of truth is this. There's only two things that make us unhappy. One is not getting what we want, and the other is getting what we want. Now notice the mind's response to that, because the mind now wants to argue and the mind wants to, but if you look at your life, you'll see thousands and thousands of times that this is a statement that's absolutely true. If getting what we wanted would make us happy, then we would just be happy for the rest of our lives, because we're the type of people that pursue what we want in a more extreme way than I think the average person. So it's just a sort of an interesting thing. And it's sort of a good lead into, because I want to talk about three and how three sort of convicts us of something that maybe we didn't notice. And then the resentment inventory, I want to kind of get into that. And that's a tool that AA has to kind of look at our thinking and to kind of look at our lives and to look at the one of the biggest areas of spiritual block that we have, which is the resentment inventory. As a matter of fact, it says that resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. That's a pretty heavy-duty statement. So let's get into it. I'm on page 60 in the big book. In the middle of the page, in the at the end of the How It Works reading, it says, our description of the alcoholic, step one, the chapter to the agnostic, step two, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that I am alcoholic and could not manage my own life. That's step one, and that principle is honesty. B is that probably no human power could have relieved my alcoholism. That's step two, and that principle is humility. And then C, that God could and would if he were sought, which is also step two, and that spiritual principle is hope. So at the end of the How It Works reading, it gives us an overview of the first two steps, which is kind of interesting, because prior to the beginning of How It Works, step one and step two is not mentioned at all. As a matter of fact, there was no step one and step two until Bill started writing How It Works. And then from the beginning of when he wrote How It Works, then for the first time in world history, the 12 steps appeared onto the scene. And then now in the rest of the book, he says, okay, well, now we're at step three, and this is something about step three, and then now we're at step four. So as of the writing of the beginning of this chapter, prior to that, the 12 steps did not exist yet. Now, there were certain practices that the Oxer Group and the early AA members worked with, but there was no 12 steps. There was basically the six tenets of the Oxa group. And tenet is sort of an oldish word, so let me just describe what a tenet is in my thinking. And that is that in the Oxa group, they had these six tenets. As far as I'm concerned, a tenet is sort of like a point of emphasis. Now, I've seen in Oxa group literature, and just so you know, the Oxa group's where it came from. In Oxa group literature, I've seen the six tenets mentioned many times. And it's interesting because it's usually not mentioned in the same order. So unlike the steps, which are meant to be worked in order, the six tenets of the Oxa group, the six points of emphasis, were just, you know, some people started when they came in with prayer. Some people started when they came in with inventory. Some people started when they came in with amends. Some people started when they came in working with others. So there were just six things that were emphasized, but the order was not necessarily the same for everybody. It was almost like they used the six points of emphasis as a way to meet you where they felt you should sort of begin, and then that's where you would begin. And, you know, in a period of time, you would touch upon all six as a way of life. But then when Bill took the six tenets of the Oxa group after, you know, 3 or 4 years of intense use with the six tenets of the Oxa group, he then, in prayer and meditation, and I would suggest something working through him, wrote down, filling in certain loopholes, certain now new and through all the experience that the earliest members had, points of emphasis. And when he was finished, he was like, he numbered them and he said, wow, 12, there's 12. That's significant. And in his mind, he said, well, that's significant because Jesus had 12 disciples. Now, this isn't a Christian kind of thing, but it was just sort of in his mind, that was what he was thinking. He kind of felt 12, that's like a significant number, which actually 12 is a very spiritual number also. But I guess you could say that's sort of besides the point. Now, you know, later that day, after now for the first time in human history, the 12 steps appear onto the scene. Later that day, a guy who was in AA for a while comes over to his house with a newcomer. And Bill's all excited and he says, you know, check this out, 12 steps, you know. And the guy's like, 12 steps? What are you talking about, Bill? You know, we have six tenets. Like, what are you... It would be almost like today if you came to a meeting and all of a sudden now there's 24 steps. You know what I mean? Like, this was, you know what I mean? Like, that would not go over very well, you know, so... He immediately was met with, you know, Bill, what are you talking about? You know. And Bill just said, you know, Bill was one of those guys. Bill was really, really an incredible guy. He was one of those big picture guys. He could see things from a place that most people could not see. And he saw the significance of the ways that the 12 steps filled certain loopholes that were causing problems with the six tenets, and here it is, so the 12 steps. Where this came from was Bill was writing chapters to this book, and then, you know, now he was at a point where he wanted to really, really give an overview of what goes on here, and then the rest of the book is pretty much dedicated to that, where, you know, prior to this is basically steps 1 and 2, how it works is steps 3 and 4. Into Action is an incredible chapter in that more than half of the 12 steps is found in that one chapter. 7 steps are into Action, which is incredible. And then working with others, to wives, the family afterwards, to employers, and a vision for you, as far as I see it, is all of step 12. So that's how the book goes. And then, you know, the book changes direction, and then the rest of the book is stories. Now, I've always found it significant and interesting that the name of this chapter is called How It Works. And the reason why I find it interesting is, first of all, you know, that's a pretty strong chapter statement, how it works, you know, like. And also, I find it very interesting in studying this book for, you know, 25 years, and more importantly, applying the book with 1,000 people or whatever. It's interesting in that the third step as far as I've seen, and you know, I've sort of studied it and marked it and looked at it in this way, that the third step is the most referred back to step in the whole entire book. They're constantly saying, you know, in different ways, pointing back to the third step as you know, being used throughout the rest of the book. And then something I'd like to say about the fourth step, and then we'll get into starting to read the book, is that there's a common mistake in AA, and that is that, you know, you kind of work the steps, and that it's just a tool to deal with the past. And nothing could be further from the truth. It's a tool that we first use to deal with the past, and then it's a major tool to help deal with these things as they come up in the present. So the first inventory and the fourth step is the resentment inventory, and then the fear inventory, and then the sex and harms inventory, and then there's a relationship ideal, as I see it. And when we go through the resentment inventory, let's say for the first time, we internalize a four-column inventory on how to look at our resentments from the past to help get past them. But then it's an internalized process that we've learned that when resentment comes up in the present, we then use the four-column inventory to get back on the beam. So it's really, really important to see and to use the steps in a way that it's not just about the past. We use the four-column inventory in the fourth step to look at the past and to internalize the process, and then we use that process to deal with stuff that comes up in the present. Like I had said last week, in talking to lots of people constantly, you know, when people call pretty quickly, you can easily see the person's calling because they have a resentment or the person's calling because they have a fear. And, you know, I immediately get them into the four-column inventory because we have to get free of this stuff. This is the stuff that destroys more alcoholics than anything else, so we have to get free of it. It's not some minor thing. It's not something that we just let them rant. The further that they go, perhaps I could even say the closer they are to their next drink without their knowing it. Seriously. So we got the ABCs, and then for the first time it introduces the steps, and you know, sort of more officially. And it says, being convinced of the first two steps, we are at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God, over to God as we understood him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? So the third step, I'm not going to get into this as intensely as I do when I do sort of a step workshop, because I'm trying to be a little bit more loose and loaded with this workshop. I'd rather just be spontaneous and have fun, and that'll make it more interesting for me, and I don't care if it's interesting for you. It's all about me, still. Sorry. And in that way, it comes out in the way that it comes out, and it's not as... I would rather it just be that way. I'd rather this workshop be sort of loose and loaded, so that's how I'm approaching it. Now, the third step, for me, has sort of three words. The word... decide, the word, and the words will and life, that sort of need to be basically overviewed as far as I'm concerned, because sometimes we as alcoholics tend to translate instead of just reading what's the black on the page. We read something and then we translate. Like, for instance, I remember admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, and when I'm drinking, my life is unmanageable. But that's not what it says. But that's what I internalized. That's how I translated it. That's how my cunning, baffling, and powerful mind, you know, took me in a completely different direction than what it's saying. And so I just want to be clear on the words in the third step. And the first word being made a decision. Decision. A decision always requires further action. So, in other words, I made a decision to come here tonight, but if I didn't take the action to get here, that decision means nothing. So, will and life, as Howard sort of went over it with me, and that I still sort of use it to go over it with people that I work with, my will is my thinking, and my life are the actions that I've taken up until this point in my life. So to sort of translate the third step to its essence, let's say, that is that I decide to take the actions necessary to turn my thinking and my actions over to the care of a higher power. At the end of the third step, it talks about, though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. And I'll get to that and I'll explain that later, but it even gets into explaining what the decision is. I'll get to that when we get to it. The book continues. The first requirement is that I be convinced, and I try to personalize the book as much as possible because, you know, when it's referring to they and the alcoholic and we or whatever, that's a completely different element than if I personalize the book and say, you know, I. It makes it more real for me. So you'll see as I read, I'm personalizing it somewhat, and I don't care if you do or not. It's just helpful for me, and I think with people that I work with, it's been very helpful. Instead of saying what they did, you know, or what's significant for them, if it's significant for me, and then it just makes it more real. That any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. The first requirement is that I be convinced that any life run on self-will could hardly be a success. Now, it's saying that my life run on my will is not going to be successful. I never overview that with anybody that I ever work with, nor do I ever discuss it much with groups that I present in front of. And the reason is because when you do your fourth and fifth step, that statement will become not only obvious, but sort of an understatement. But until you do your fourth and fifth step, you're not going to understand it at all. So there's no sense in me talking about an experience that someone may or may not have had. So I can't really explain that sentence, but when you do your fourth and fifth step, that sentence will be more than obvious and somewhat of an understatement. So, you know, stay tuned if you haven't gotten there yet, and if you have gotten there already, you know what it means. And then it says, on that basis, I am almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. I try to live by self-propulsion. Notice it says most people. Let me just continue. I try to live by self-propulsion. I am like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the ballet, the lights, the scenery, and the rest of the players in my own way. If my arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as I wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including myself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. Now, I had talked about this in previous weeks about each morning we wake up and we have this script in our head. And then when we leave our house, we're surrounded by script violators. And not only was that news to me and really obvious when put that way, something that's a little bit further than the fact that I have a script in my head and I'm surrounded by script violators is that what I often don't notice is that everybody else has a script in their head, and I'm a script violator to them. So, you know, and this is the way we live life, you know what I mean? Like, this is called human life, or American life, and, you know, you put on the news and you see the results of this, you know what I mean? Like, there's this constant clash of they're not acting the way I want them to, and unhappiness, and misery, and suffering, and it's all self-induced, basically. And then it says, in trying to make these arrangements, I may sometimes be quite virtuous. I may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, I may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, I am more likely to have varied traits. Now, I can't speak for you, but I can speak for me. And that is that the reason why, in order to try to get my script done, in order to get my script to be played out, sometimes I can be very nice and sometimes I can be a little bit mean and pushy. And the reason why it's that way is because it just depends on what's going to get my way. I have no concern for you. I have a script and I'm out there trying to make this script happen. And it's interesting because nobody knows what my script is, you know what I mean? Like, I think it should be obvious to you, but I've never told anybody what my script is. You know, my script is everybody should get out of the way on the road, all the lights should be green, you know, my boss shouldn't hassle me. I should be able allowed to just do whatever I want to do with there to be no repercussions. You know, I should say whatever I want to say. There should be no, you know, don't you know who I am? That I, most of my life, I went around from the standpoint of, don't you know who I am? You know what I mean? And of course, nobody knows who I am because I'm a big deal to me, but I'm not a big deal to anybody else. It's certainly not compared to how much of a big deal you are to you. You know what I mean? Like, you know, I can, in order to get my way, I can be nice, and if that doesn't work, then I can be mean, or I can start with being mean if I think that's going to work. But, you know, this is how it goes. This is how selfish, self-centered people live their lives. And, you know, it's interesting because this is the part of the book that I just really dropped my jaw and said, one, I really thought that drinking was my problem. What are you talking about now? And two, how did these people know this about me? I've never met them. You know what I mean? Like, they didn't see me running rampant in my life. Wait a minute, I'm convicted now. You know, it's like, wait a minute, where are they going with this? Like, this doesn't have anything to do with anything. Why are you looking at me? You know what I mean? So it's interesting how the book basically just turns on us and it gets ugly. It gets really ugly. Then it says, what usually happens? The show doesn't go off very well. I begin to think that life doesn't treat me right. I decide to exert myself more. I become, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play doesn't suit me. Admitting I may be somewhat at fault, I am sure that other people are more to blame. He says this again a few pages later on page 66. He says, to conclude that others was wrong, it was as far as most of us had ever gotten. So, you know, this is an extreme self-centered point of view. And I am busted. You know, I'm starting to become busted. And then we get into the fourth step, and now I am super busted. Like, I always thought that they were the problem. And then what I discovered by working the steps, and especially with 4 and 5, I realized that I'm the creator of all my suffering and all my misery. And, you know, how do you go from one extreme to the other? I thought that you and the world were entirely to blame. And then what I discovered was that I was entirely to blame. Like, how could you be so off? You know what I mean? How could you be so wrong? But that's the beauty of the steps, is that we're hit with the truth, and it is ugly. You know, the truth will set us free, but it will piss us off first. And, you know, generally, what this is talking about is manipulation. You know, we think we know what's best for you. I think I know what's best for you. I think I know what's best for the world. And I think I know what's best for God. And, you know, if you act the way I think you should, not only will you be happy, I'll be happy, and the world will be a better place. So, you know, don't you know who I am? You know what I mean? Like, this is how I go around, playing God everywhere I go. And it's a failed system. It's a disgustingly failed system. But it's a system that a lot of people use for their whole entire lives and then die and never notice any of this. So for me, it's really fortunate here in AA because, you know, the spotlight gets turned on us. And it's really, really significant, especially from a spiritual point of view. Then it says that, admitting I may be somewhat at fault, I am sure that other people are more to blame. I become angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is my basic trouble? Am I not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Am I not a victim of the delusion or the lie that I can rest? Rest means to take away by force. The word wrestling comes from that word. So, am I not the victim of the delusion that I can take away by force satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I can only manage well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things that I want? And do not my actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Am I not, even in my best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? And the interesting thing is that my mind has me convinced that I'm well-intentioned. I don't see what I'm doing as wrong at all. As a matter of fact, I don't understand why you're not grateful. You know what I mean? Like, I'm going to run your life now, and you should be grateful because I'm playing God. And I have to be honest with you, this is on a good day. You know what I mean? Like, this is when it's a good day. There's these ugly days that are just really disastrous and really just so obvious and so pathetic and so disgusting. But in my mind, not only is it reasonable, but, you know, like, people should be bowing down to me. You know what I mean? Like, it's really crazy how we go through life sometimes. And I can't speak for you, but I don't know anybody in AA that doesn't relate to this in some level. So I will speak for you then. And you know how it sometimes mentioned to us by people around us is you know, somebody that we care for, somebody that's been just trampled on by our manipulations, says, you know, you're just so selfish. You are so selfish. You know what I mean? And I don't understand what they're talking about. In all honesty, I don't know what you're talking about. I mean, I think that you should be grateful. So it's really interesting in this part of the book, especially because, you know, like I said, I mean, it just gets ugly. And it needs to, because it is ugly. It's pathetic how we are. You know, later in the book, it talks about, even in step 9, it talks about, you know, we just destroy the people around us. We're like a tornado. We destroy the people around us. You know, good relationships are dead. Not mediocre or bad relationships. Good relationships are dead. We just destroy. We suck the life out of everything that's around us and then just destroy it. It's really crazy. And I never noticed. You know what I mean? I never noticed. The worst thing that ever happened to me was nothing that anybody else ever did. The worst thing that ever happened to me was I was incapable of loving. Because don't you know who I am? Now I have these expectations, and now you're not living up to the expectations, and now I need to withhold love because you don't deserve it. This is how I live. This is how unsuccessful my life was. I was incapable of loving another human being. And I was incapable of loving myself. I was in a constant state of doing stuff that I knew I shouldn't be doing and not doing stuff that I knew I should be doing. But again, I just want to say this. I hardly noticed. That's the amazing thing. The mind is so cunning, baffling, and powerful. It just has me convinced that everything's okay. And nothing could be further from the truth. Even in my best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony. And it says, I am self-centered, egocentric, as some people like to call it nowadays. I am like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation. And let me reword that sentence to a way that maybe some of us can relate. I am like the retired businessman who lulls at New Jersey AA meetings in the winter, complaining about the sad state of AA. Nobody here does that, right? The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave or act as I think they should. The outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, and our self-pity? You see, what it turns into is, since they're the blame, we are not, in truth, we're the victimizers. But in our mental reality, we're the victims. That's how much the mind has it twisted. And I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but victims don't get sober. I could argue about that forever, but victims don't get sober. We have to find a way to move away from being a victim, because that's not reality. Nothing could be further from the truth. Like Chris S. says, our problems don't come at us, our problems come from us. And when we do the fourth and fifth step, that will be beyond clear. Then it says, selfish, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, I step on the toes of my fellows, column 1, and they retaliate, column 2 of the resentment inventory. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, column 3. But I invariably or constantly find that at some time in the past I have made decisions based on self, column 4 of the resentment inventory, which later placed me in a position to be hurt, column 2 and 3. Karma is a bitch. But it's a great teacher. You know, for a really, really long time, I hated my conscience. And now I love my conscience. Because I want to know when I'm wrong, and I want to know when I'm off. Because I've lived the other way, and I don't want to live that way anymore. I need help. I need lots of help. And my conscience is one of the biggest. Perhaps my biggest spiritual help is my conscience. So I need to be aware and sensitive to its promptings. And that's what the steps do. The steps bring us to a place where the voice of God within us, which is always and already there, can speak in a way that we can hear it. Because I don't know about you, but... Or I do know about you, actually. Within us, we have these two committees. You know, one is the itty-bitty shitty committee. And it's, you know, selfish and self-centered and afraid. And its mantra is, what's in it for me? And, you know, all of that. And then there's this other committee. Because it seems like a committee of voices in my head, you know what I mean? Like, it comes at me in different ways. It's not always the same strategy and always the same sort of voice. Sometimes it's subtler, sometimes it's forceful, sometimes... And, you know, ultimately, once we're on the spiritual path, it all and only comes down to one thing. Which voice are you listening to? And there's the unhealthy voice, and then there's the healthy voice. And the healthy voice is of love, and of honesty, and of unselfishness. And not what's in it for me, but how can I be more importantly than do? And sometimes my being drives what I do, but it's about the primary is the being and the secondary is the doing, coming from the being. And at any one moment on the spiritual path, it's always and only one thing. Which voice am I listening to? And that's what the steps are all about, is that in the middle steps, we get a major overview of what it looks like and what it feels like when we're listening to the wrong voice. Because the healthy voice really almost can't be described. God can't be described. When you try to describe your higher power, the descriptions ruin it. It's about the experience. It's not about the concept. And the steps are just this incredible thing where in steps 2 and 3, it says, it sort of points us in the direction of this higher power thing is important, but we're not going to talk much about that. It just says the importance of the need of that and the importance of that this is something that is always and already here for all of us. And then it says, okay, that's besides the point. Now let's overview in a major way what it looks like and what it feels like when we're listening to the wrong voice. And then we start to move away from following that. And then the healthy voice sort of rises to the forefront instead of being blocked by the unhealthy voice. You could call one the higher power and call one the lower power. I have to be honest with you, up until recently, I liked the word higher power, and I no longer like it. And what I mean by that is that the term that I'm now using and that I like much more than higher power is highest power. Because like a higher power can take me beyond, even in a minimal way, can take me beyond however it is that I showed up when I came in here. But a highest power can take me way beyond whatever it was that I brought here when I came here. So I really, really love that term, highest power, because it says more clearly what I'm trying to say. I rarely use the word God, because if I use the word God here, you know, maybe there's 40 people here. I use the word God, and 40 people internalize 40 completely different things. So that word is not very useful as far as I'm concerned. When I speak, I try to speak in a way where I'm clear on what I'm trying to convey and that people hear kind of what I try to convey. And I just recently started using the term highest power. So to do with as you wish. Then it says, so our troubles we think are basically of our own making. Now, in my book, right next to that, I put the word hope with an exclamation point next to it. And I remember I was at one of my previous home groups in Berkeley Heights that I know Sue from, and the person next to me saw that I had hope written there, and after the meeting was over, he was like, "What's the story with what you wrote in the margin? How is that my troubles are my own making? How is that a statement of hope? That sounds like I'm screwed." And I said, well, for me, it's a statement of hope, because if you're to blame or if life is to blame, what can I do about that? There's no, if I'm the victim, that's a lost game. That's an endlessly lost game. But if I'm creating my problems, that's the only thing that I can do something about, that me with my higher power can do something about that. And that's what our program's all about, and that's what our fellowship's all about, and that's what the transformation's all about, and that's what the steps are all about, and that's what the big book's all about, and that's what every religion is all about, and every spiritual path, that's what it's all about. Every single spiritual path and every single religion, they all say exactly the same thing. They say that within you, always and already, within you, there is something that is of God, and that there is a way to tap into that and to be able to listen to it more and more clearly. And then once you get in more conscious contact with that part of you, which is in all of us, then you live from that place. And that's it. Every religion and every spiritual path and AA, that's what it says. And it's a beautiful thing. And we have sort of our way and we have our language, and other paths have their way and their languages, and nobody has the full truth. We all have a piece of it. Nobody has the absolute truth. We all have pieces of it. And for alcoholics, the 12 steps reaches us in a specially effective way. I would never say that the big book is the only way. I would say that the big book is the most effective way for the most amount of people that have alcoholism. So, and I've even heard of people that don't have alcoholism that it's been helpful to them. Not even people that are drug addicts, just people that are suffering with life that have been able to use the 12 steps to help them. There's over 300 12-step fellowships currently. It's amazing. Then it says, so our troubles are our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and I am an extreme example of self-will run riot, though I usually don't think so. You know what I mean? Like, I don't see it at all. When I first was reading this, I was thinking to myself, you know, where are they going with this? This isn't part of what's my problem, you know? Above everything is a pretty strong statement. Above everything, I must be rid of this selfishness. I must, or it kills me. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them, even though we would have liked to. Neither could we reduce my self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on my own power. I had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, I had to quit playing God. It didn't work. And then now notice what it says here. This is what the actual decision is. This is the third step decision. It says, next, I decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God is going to be the director. He is the principal. I am his agent. He is the father, and we are his children. And in the original manuscript, which is what the big book looked like before they made the last changes in it, it said, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. I am his agent. He is the father, and we are his children. And then it said, get that simple relationship straight. And I am so pissed that they took that sentence out. But there it is again. You know what I mean? And then in a couple sentences, it talks about that God is our employer. So it mentions that God's the director, God's the principal, God's the father, and God's the employer. So if God is the director, I need to be asking him what I should be doing. I would never walk into my boss's office. I don't have a boss, but if I had a boss, I would never walk into my boss's office and say, this is what I'm doing, I don't care what you think. I wouldn't be working there for very long. I walk into my boss's office and I say, what do you got for me today? What do you want me to do? He knows the big picture, just like God knows the big picture. We cannot know the big picture, but we can know the one that does know the big picture. We can connect with that. And then he's the principal, we're his agents, so now we're supposed to be representing him everywhere we go. And then he is the father, and we are his children. God has no grandchildren. I stole that line from somebody, I don't even remember anymore. And if God is the Father and we're His brother, we're His children, then we need to start acting as if we're all brothers and sisters. Imagine what the world would be like. Imagine what your corner of the universe would be like. Imagine what you interacting with your family, if that was going on, what it would be like. Imagine if you were acting this way with your kids, what your world would be like. And then it says, most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. And then it gives us the third step promises, and then it gives us the third step prayer. And then at the bottom of page 63, it says, next we launch out on a course of vigorous, which means strenuous action. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Sometimes I like looking at the sentences in the big book and ask myself, is that my experience? And before I came to A, I never even considered doing an inventory. So I never even heard of anybody that did an inventory. So, you know, it's interesting how it says many of us had never attempted this. Well, you know, that's such an understatement. Though our decision was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by the strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and to conditions. So it says, though our decision, the third step decision, was a vital and crucial step, it was definitely very important, but it says it could have little permanent effect. It's important, but it means nothing unless at once, immediately, followed by a strenuous, very active, very intense activity, effort to face, and the way we face these things in 4, 5, 6, and 7, and the way we get, or in 4, 5, and 6, and the way we get rid of these things is in steps 7, 8, and 9. And then, I don't remember if I said this in one of my previous presentations over the last couple of weeks, but I'll say it again because it applies here. The steps are about relationships. A relationship with ourselves, a relationship with others, and a relationship with God. In the first three steps, we get headed in the right direction with our relationship with God. In steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, we get headed in the right direction with our relationship with ourselves. In steps 8 and 9, we get headed in the right direction with our relationship with others. And then in 10, we deepen and broaden our relationship with ourselves. In 11, we deepen and broaden our relationship with God. In 12, we deepen and broaden our relationship with others. So, the way we face and get rid of these things is using steps 4 through 9 or 4 through 12 on a daily basis as a way of life, as a design for living. Very, very important. So we had to get down to causes and conditions. So then it introduces step 4. And at the bottom of 64, it introduces us to the resentment inventory for the first time. Now, when I first started writing my first resentment inventory, the most shocking part of it was that I was really, really amazed at how many resentments I had. Because you see, in your mind, you really only have like one or two or three things going on there. You don't see the whole picture. But then when you're given an inventory and you write down all the people you're pissed at and all the people that you have issues with, and you give your mind, the mind loves complaining about people. So it sees this inventory as, this is great. I love complaining about people. I mean, think about, you know, when you were sort of not doing well, it might have been recently, how much of your time is spent on the phone complaining to your friends about something that's going on? About your spouse, about work. We're just in a constant state of complaint. Now, I have a really, really extreme definition for resentment. Resentment comes from the word sentire, which means to feel. When you put re in front of it, it means to feel again. So resentment, to resent, means to re-feel any negative emotion. We don't just experience it, but we turn on the... It's like a sports match where they say, oh, you know, let's go back to the videotape and watch that play again. Like, we replay it and we replay it. And the more we replay it in our head and in our gut, the worse and worse the other person gets, and less involved we are. This is how the replay thing works in our head. You know what I mean? But I have a really, really extreme definition for the word resentment. And it's so extreme that it's... like, I've had people write their first two columns of the resentment inventory, and then when they're done, before they go on to the third and fourth column, I then give them the definition. And they're just like, wow. And then they go back to the resentment inventory, and they can almost, like, double the amount of resentments that they write down. Because this definition is so radical and so extreme. And the definition that I use for the word resentment is this. Any real or imagined reason for a complaint. And that's the definition of the word grievance. I went into a dictionary one time. I was reading a spiritual book, and they kept talking about grievances, and I thought I knew what the word grievance meant because I used to work for AT&T, and I used to be a union representative, and we used to process grievances. So I thought I knew what grievances meant, and then I went to the dictionary, and I saw that definition, any real or imagined reason for complaint, and I said that is the perfect definition for a resentment, and that is, you know, one of the deeper ways of really seeing what's going on here, because mostly we think resentment is just, you know, the worst people that we have issues with, but it includes all the minor stuff as well. We can get free of all of that as well. And very often in some of the minor stuff is where the linchpin exists, where we get into some of the minor stuff of reasons for complaint, and that's what pulls the thread that absolutely drops the whole entire thing. Some of the bigger ones we've known, and it's been there. And then we start seeing some of the minor ones, and it's like, wow, this is what's been holding up the whole structure. And then we go about it in the four-column inventory as the resentment outlines. Now, the big book, Resentment Inventory, is a four-column inventory. The first column is basically who are we resentful at, who do we have grudges toward, who and what are the reasons for complaint. So the first column is, you know, who or what do we have issues with, and the second column is what's the issue. And then the third column is how did it affect us emotionally on the inside, and it lists seven areas of self. So not only do we have a resentment, but then we have seven areas of self that are churned up within us, and in some cases all seven areas are hooked, and in some cases not all seven areas of self are hooked. And then the fourth column, between the third and fourth column, there's a prayer and there's a disregarding the other person entirely. Now we look at our own mistakes. And I don't know about you, but when I first was proposed that direction, my only thought was, what do you mean? They were completely to blame. What my mistake? What are you talking about? I never looked at how I created the situation. And as you saw in the third step, and now in the fourth step, it's driving us toward every single problem, issue, difficulty, etc. that you have ever had was created by your thinking. It's never what they do that is the problem. It's what I tell myself about what they do that's the problem. This is a life-changing revelation. And since resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else, I really need to find something useful. And in the between the third and fourth column, there's this element of forgiveness, which is, remember, that was what the topic is of this workshop. And then there's this, I resolutely look at my own mistakes. And always, without exception, my mistakes are something that I'm doing, something that I'm not doing, or how I'm choosing to think about what happened. It only comes down to three things. Something that I did, something that I didn't do, or the way that I'm choosing to think about what happened. Because, I'm sorry if this is news to some of you, a thought is a completely unreliable thing. And to prove it, we could change our mind at any time. Every single person in this room had some really strongly held concept, and over a period of time, we saw it differently. So if a thought can be changed at any time, how significant is the thought? There's a really, really great spiritual book, and it goes like this, that as humans, we only have one problem, and that is an unquestioned thought. That is so cool. That is so succinct. That is so true. The only problem you have is an unquestioned thought. So as soon as you find yourself complaining about something, we need to step back, use a four-column inventory, maybe use forgiveness, try to talk to somebody, try to find some other way of looking at it so that it's no longer a problem. It's literally as simple as that. Thought creates the problem. Disregarding the thought ends the problem. Now, thinking is very convincing and very cunning, baffling, and powerful. Don't underestimate the simplicity of how I'm describing it. It's literally that simple, but it's not that simple. You know what I mean? Like, the mind is very convincing. And what's interesting about the mind is the ego can even rebuild itself, which really pisses me off. Because the ego can have me convinced that she's Satan. You know what I mean? And then I'm just like, oh, no. I'm not following that. I'm not agreeing. I don't agree. I'm not buying into that thought. And then the mind will kind of just, okay, well, I didn't hook him that way, so now I have to think of another strategy. You go, she's not Satan because she doesn't do the dishes. She's Satan because she doesn't make the bed. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? There's this bait and switch that happens. That the mind keeps throwing up ways to kind of get us off the beam. And it's like, you know, think me. And then if that doesn't work, then it kind of ducks down and says, okay, let's regroup. The committee regroups, you know what I mean? Like, what else can we throw at him? You know, what else can we do to convince him that, convince him into unhappiness? You know, basically, that's what's happening. How else can we reconvince him into misery? Because that's all that's happening. Every sadness you've ever had was because of a thought. Every problem you've ever had was because of a thought. There's a really, really great Anthony DeMello quote. Anthony DeMello is this really incredible Catholic mystic Indian guy. Just one of the greatest spiritual teachers of all time. And he had this really, really incredible way of describing a resentment that is just so clear. It just cuts through everything. Like, it's undeniable. And the quote goes like this. On the occasion of your behavior, I upset myself. Is that like so perfect or what? I mean, that is absolutely perfect. It's absolutely perfect. You could not put it any better. I can't imagine it being any better. On the occasion of your behavior, I upset myself. That's what's going on. And think about this just for a second. That's been a major part of our entire life. A major part of our entire life. But you're to blame. I'm a victim. You're to blame. On the occasion of your behavior, I upset myself. That is absolute truth. Another way that he put it goes like this. Think of somebody you are living with or working with whom you do not like, who causes you negative feelings to arise in you. Let's help you understand what's going on here. The first thing you need to understand is that the negative feeling is inside you. You are responsible for the negative feeling, not the other person. Someone else in your place may be perfectly calm and at ease in the presence of this person. They would not be affected at all. You are. Now, understand another thing, that you're making a demand. You have an expectation on this person. Can you get in touch with that? Then say to this person, I have no right to make any demands on you. In saying that, you will drop your expectation. I have no right to make any demands on you. Oh, I'll protect myself from the consequences of your actions or your moods or whatever. But you can go right ahead and be what you choose to be. I have no right to make any demands on you. And then he continues busting us even further. He says, see what happens to you when you do this. If there is a resistance to you, my, how much you're going to discover about your ego. Let the dictator in you come out. Let the little tyrant in you come out. You thought you were such a silly lamb. You were such a nice person, didn't you? But we can be a little tyrant, a little dictator. I want to run your life for you. I want to tell you exactly how you're expected to be and how you're expected to behave. And you'd better behave as I have decided, or I shall punish myself by having negative feelings. I mean, this guy just like gets into it. You know what I mean? I love these people that can just describe it in such an incredibly clear way. It's absolutely undeniable. Oh, wow, it just started raining. Now, there's another way that I like breaking down resentments. And this is when we're going to get more into what the whole purpose of this workshop was, because everything up until now was just fluff. And what I mean by that is that one of my teachers, I was having an experience where he was doing a retreat, and I went to the retreat. And during the retreat, he was talking about anger, and he said this one just incredibly clear statement that absolutely blew my mind. He said that, I'm going to say resentment. He said anger, but I'm going to say resentment. He said anger can be broken down into four parts. If you were to take a microscope and really get into the essence of resentment, it's actually a four-part process. The first, this is like so crazy. The first part is, I judge you. The second part is, I find you guilty. And then the third part is I get frustrated or angry about it. And then the fourth part is I begin to re-feel the anger or the frustration, which is now a resentment. So you can see that the resentment isn't the issue. The resentment is the surface thing. What's going on there is that I judge you and I find you guilty. Ultimately, that's what's going on. That's where we need to look. That's where we need to bring ourselves energetically and spiritually. That's why I personally think that forgiveness is a shallow spiritual practice. And it's relatively lame. Because forgiveness is only needed when I'm still playing the game of judging you and finding you guilty. Then forgiveness is useful. But if I don't judge you, there is absolutely nothing to forgive. And that's a beautiful place. There's this really great quote that goes like this. Forgiveness is not letting bygones be bygones. It is coming to the realization that, seen from the spiritual perspective, nothing wrong ever happens. Therefore, there is nothing to forgive. This is the whole premise of my presentation today. The topic that I put on the flyer was, is forgiveness enough? And I would like to suggest that it is not. What we really need to start to look at is the fact that we judge and we're not capable of it. And it never goes well. We don't judge happy-go-lucky, you know what I mean? Like, we judge victim and you're screwing me and you're disrespecting me and all the stuff that I shared with three and leading up to the resentment inventory. That's the issue. And, you know, after it talks about sort of, it talks about that we have to come from a completely different place. In the first three columns, we're coming from the head, and we're letting the minds and the ego throw up on a series of pieces of paper about all the issues that we have toward everybody, and it's ugly. And what I discovered was, I didn't think that resentment was that big of a deal. I didn't think that fear was that big of a deal. And then when I did the fear retreat, I was like, oh my God. I am like, it's a nightmare. The fear is a nightmare. And I am pissed at everybody. If anybody crossed paths even just for an hour, like, I have an issue with you. You know what I mean? Like, you're not acting the way I want you to, because I always play God, because I'm selfish and self-centered. I look for validation and I look for happiness outside of me. And validation and happiness can only be found inside of us. And only if we have love and compassion toward ourselves, then and only then can we have love and compassion toward somebody else. We cannot give away something that we don't have for ourselves. Most often, the worst resentments that we have are behaviors that others did that we did ourselves. And we're simply seeing in somebody else something we don't like about ourselves. Most, if not all, of the worst resentments that we have are stuff that usually we also did. And we're judging them because we judged ourselves. And we need to get free of that. We will always judge them if we judge ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean that we can behave in any way. and just say, well, you know, I can do anything. I don't judge. You know what I mean? We all know that that's crap. You know what I mean? However, let me put it this way. I don't know about you, but half the time, I don't even know what's right for me. How do I know what's right for somebody else? You know what I mean? I don't know what's right for me most of the time. So how am I to judge? Yet that was the way we lived. And now we have an inventory and we have a bunch of tools. And like I said, what it says specifically is in the sort of the second paragraph of, or the third paragraph of 67, it says, we avoid retaliation or argument. Referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, I resolutely look for my own mistakes. Where had I been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though the situation was not entirely my fault, I tried to disregard the other person entirely. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, those two phrases, I disregard the other person entirely, and putting out of my mind the wrongs others had done. Nowhere in the book does it say, okay, now you can start thinking about them again. Now you can start making yourself a victim again. As far as I'm concerned, that's the deeper part of that book that's sometimes missed, that is pointing toward it's not about forgiveness. It's about not judging. It's about putting down the bat. It's about not judging me, and it's about not judging you. There's a famous quote from Shakespeare's Hamlet. I just wanted to quote this to impress you. So I sound cultured, because I'm not. And basically what it says is, there is no good or bad, but thinking makes it so. It's interesting, all the stuff that we have going on up here. There's another really great phrase that I love. I use it constantly. And it goes like this. We all have a Grand Central Station mind, but we don't have to get on every train that comes through the station. I mean, that's me. That's me in a sentence. You know what I mean? Like, we all have a Grand Central Station mind. You know, as soon as I leave the house, I got the Howard Cosell thing going on. Yeah, I come from the Howard Cosell generation. Some of you don't know who I'm talking about. But you know what I mean? I got the Howard Cosell commentator. You know what I mean? Like, you can't just watch a football game. You have to listen to these guys just going on incessantly about nothing. Half the time I shut the volume off because it's like, you know, I don't care about, you know, the guy's knee injury. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I just want to watch the game. I don't care about, you know, that was the fourth time that he used his middle finger to touch the ball. Like, I don't care. I'm just really impressed by these people's athleticism. You know what I mean? Like, it's amazing. Sports are amazing. It's amazing what God does through people, men and women. You know, there's an exercise that I'm working with. There's an exercise I'm working with now. I'm not suggesting you work with it. It just came up, so now I'm going to share it. And it's been interesting in how it's quieted the mind. It was just something that I heard not too long ago from Eckhart Tolle in A New Earth. And somebody came to him and said, it was somebody that knew him, and they brought a brochure to a spiritual center. I think it was Omega, actually, in Rhinebeck, New York. It's a pretty cool spiritual center. They have a lot of teachers and stuff like that. And the guy brought the brochure of the full year's schedule and gave it to this great spiritual teacher and said, you know, why don't you pick one retreat for me to go to? Like, can you imagine going to somebody and, like, imposing on them? Like, you know what I mean? Like, pick one. There's, like, hundreds of programs. Pick one. And Eckhart said that, you know, he looked through the brochure a little bit, but, you know, he wasn't interested in entertaining this guy's demands. So he handed the brochure back to the guy, and he goes, listen, you know, there's too many to choose from. I really don't know which one to pick. But he goes, if you want a free retreat, do this for the next year. As much as possible on a daily basis, just become aware of your breathing. And he goes, you'll benefit as much or more for free than you will having gone to a retreat. And I was just like, oh my God, that is so amazing. And ever since then, as much as I can, even sometimes when I'm talking or when I'm doing something, I just lower my awareness from here, the craziness of the mind to just here, where there's peace and quiet, and just the reality of the breath, and the reality of I inhale and it expands, and I exhale and it contracts. And it's like a vacation. And that's why, you know, in a past session I mentioned to you guys about, you know, genuine listening during meetings. That during a meeting, if we can just put our full attention and nothing else on whoever's speaking, that we just spent an hour outside of our head. Oh my God, what a vacation. You know what I mean? That there's these little pointers and that these little presence reminders, let's call them, that can go from she's disrespecting me. They're, you know, this old man with a hat needs to get out of my car, get out of my way because he's driving under the speed limit. And then I disengage from that, which is a story that has me hooked. You know what I mean? Because, yeah, they are going under the speed limit. Don't they know who I am, right? And then to just what's really going on here, the heart is pumping and the lungs are breathing. The miracle of life, literally. The miracle of life happening at every moment, and we completely overlook it, right? We go from the problem to no problem. And then all of a sudden, yeah, there's a guy driving in front of me. And I want to get there 1 minute later than I would have. Big whoopee. Right? And then I get there and I'm all right and I'm clear and I'm not spitting bullets like I would have if I was in the car with that guy, which I had been. Right? It's a really beautiful way to start your day. The very, very first moment that you wake up, the first moment that you realize that you woke up, don't get up right away. Don't even move. Just bring your awareness into your body and just notice sensations. Just notice, how does your foot feel with the blankets on it? How does your shoulder feel with your clothing on? Where's the position of my tongue? Where's the aches and pains today? I'm 58 now, so, you know, it's like, where's the aches and pains today? You know what I mean? Instead of just bringing it into the busyness and the craziness. Instead of bringing it into the problem, just bringing it into the rightness of this moment, which doesn't struggle unless you add a thought to it. That's something that I discovered. This might be hard for you to believe, but I was listening to a spiritual teacher on video one time, and in the middle of the video, my mind stopped. And it's funny because somebody said to me, how did you know that your mind stopped? And I said, listen, when your whole life has been in a room with 20 radios blasting at you and all those radios just shut off, you know that your mind just stopped. You know what I mean? Like, I had never experienced like my mind stopping. And it just stopped. It shut off, literally. And I remember I paused the video and I just like sat there. And it was just this incredibly beautiful experience of bliss and contentment. And it stayed that way for a few days. And I was able to drive. I was able to eat and feed myself. Because somebody said, if your mind stops, you're not going to be able to feed yourself. Because how do you find which hole to put the food in? It's not like that. There's an automatic pilot that's still there called consciousness. And what was funny was I was sitting at my desk at work the first day, and I was staring at the tree. I was like one with the tree. Like I was distracted from working. I was like one with the tree that was just outside the window. And a series of thoughts kind of just went through that didn't come from me. And I'm sorry, I'm going over. And what it said was, this is what the phrase, the truth will set you free, means. And I was just like, how is this an example of the truth will set you free? And it said, the truth is, what is truth? The truth is whatever is happening in this second without adding a story on top of it. And that's why the truth will set you free, because what is all right. It's not a problem. But as soon as you add a story to it, now you created the problem and now you're not set free. So the truth sets you free, because if you could just be with what is without adding a story on top of it, like this shouldn't be happening or whatever, that literally the truth sets you free, because the truth is always and already all right. So this was my little presentation about forgiveness isn't enough. There's a deeper spiritual thing. Thank you. Also, I have a handout for everybody if you guys want to check it out.